The British government has released a raft of policies today, all aimed at hitting ambitious carbon reduction targets.
And I'm pleased to announce two major government initiatives, the Net Zero Strategy and the Heat and Building Strategy.
Said to be the most comprehensive plan of any major industrialised country. And with just...
To adapt Gordon Gekko, may or may not be a hero of anybody in this room, green is good, green is right, green works.
Hello and welcome to another very special edition of the Energy Matters podcast. This week, a quite significant one when it comes to energy, carbon reduction and climate change, thanks to the UN's COP26 summit, I'll be talking to SMS's Chief Operating Officer, Tim Mortlock, about the UK's Net Zero 2050 plan. Now, just days ahead of its presidency of COP26 in Glasgow, which has gathered the world's leaders with the aim of accelerating urgent global action on climate change, the UK government unveiled its long-awaited net zero strategy. The plan does finally give some much-needed policy detail as to how the government intends to enable the decarbonisation of our economy, our industry and homes by the year 2050, a commitment which it initially announced more than 2 years ago. But how well thought through is the strategy, and what role does private sector business, in partnership with the public sector, have to play in making it all happen? I'll be discussing all this and more with Tim in the episode ahead. Tim has since 2019 been COO of the SMS Group and is responsible for spearheading the organisation's diversification into a range of carbon reduction assets and smart energy infrastructure solutions. With his 25 years of experience in the energy industry, it was fascinating to hear Tim's perspective on the race to net zero and the role of the private sector in driving it forward. So with that, please do enjoy the conversation. Tim, thanks for joining me.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to have you. So I wanted to talk to you first about the government's newly announced net zero strategy blueprint, which has finally provided some meat on the bones, as it were, as regards its plan for Britain's decarbonisation by 2050. This, of course, comes just in the nick of time for the country's presidency of the COP26 Climate Change Summit in Glasgow, which is ongoing as we speak. So before I get your thoughts on that, just to reel off a few of the headline policies included in the strategy, which offer perhaps a few real surprises, but some much needed clarity on policy direction. So the government is, for example, promising the expansion of electric vehicles and the network of EV charge points over the next few years, further growth of renewable energy generation and energy storage, as well as investments in technologies such as hydrogen and low carbon heat pumps. So whilst the strategy does seem to have been broadly welcomed as a step in the right direction, as with the release of any policy of this magnitude, it has divided opinion as regards its ambition and viability of the funding required to deliver it. So as COO of SMS, may I ask what has been your general reaction to the strategy?
Well, look, I think my reaction, and I think the industry's more generally, has actually been broadly positive in that it does seem to have built significantly on the sort of 10-point plan that was sort of talked about last year. It also recognises the importance of partnering with and leveraging private sector investment, which, you know, again, is a critical component of delivering on net zero, I think. Now, welcoming it isn't quite the same thing as saying I think it's the end of the story. I think there are areas where it still needs to be fleshed out. I think the strategy itself recognises that in some cases. But what it does do is just show the size of the market opportunity for a business like us that's already operating in this space, but also the breadth of requirement that's sort of needed from private sector businesses to enable the UK to deliver on its net zero obligations and requirements. So that in you know, one of the areas where I think the policy is perhaps a bit lacking and further work is required, for example, would be around the energy efficiency strategy within the UK. So and some of the positive views I would have about it is, you know, it wasn't just a net zero strategy, there was a heat and building strategy specifically, you know, called out and issued alongside it. But You know, when you look at the 30% of emissions that come from you know, buildings in the UK, 80% of that coming from heat and so on. I feel like energy efficiency is still the poor relation of this strategy, to be perfectly honest. And when you look at the sort of solutions, so heat pumps, for example, that are proposed to significantly address that sort of decarbonisation of heat, you know, those solutions will only work with a greater focus on energy efficiency as well. So I think there are areas where further clarity is required. As I said, some of the strategy calls that out itself in terms of particularly areas where future decisions need to be made around the involvement of hydrogen in certainly in the heat agenda. But look, overall, I think the strategy is a big step forward.
So what I did want to pick up on, and really gets to the core of what I wanted to talk to you today about, that role of private sector investment, understandably considered absolutely central to reaching net zero, and something very clearly outlined by the government strategy document. So, for instance, the plan aims to leverage up to £90 billion worth of private investment by the end of this decade alone, with an additional capital investment requirement of £50 to £60 billion per year through the 2030s. So as a business that is already investing heavily to grow the UK's green infrastructure, most recently through developing the country's energy storage capacity, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. Does it leave the private sector with a potentially unrealistic gap to fill when it comes to financing net zero? Or is it a case that the private sector scope is there and it's just a case of how this can be unlocked?
Well, I wouldn't see the that gap as being, you know, unachievable in terms of private sector investment. I think the capital is there and the willingness is there to invest. I think one of the things I would point to was, if you look at development of our involvement in the energy storage market, for example, at the grid scale over the last couple of years and the development of that market more generally, you know, that's really been supported by there being some certainty around the long-term requirement for that as an asset class to support capital deployment, certainty around, or increased certainty around the revenues that flow from that as an asset class over the long term, that supports you know, businesses like us developing the capability, innovating, deploying capital into this infrastructure asset class, which is required for the long-term, you know, decarbonisation of the energy network. And when you consider the same sort of you know, considerations in other areas of the net zero requirement, so energy efficiency, as I mentioned before, but you know, the requirement for more local distributed generation and storage solutions, electric vehicle charging infrastructure, air source heat pumps, you know, these are areas which you know, I think the government needs to support from an R&D in some cases, you know, to get the cost of technology down, for example, air source heat pumps. And that's an area that I think they are doing. But they also need to make sure that the regulatory structure and the certainty over that structure over the long term and the revenues that businesses are able to access, are there's a degree of confidence that in that to support capital deployment into those and the mechanisms to, and the commercial models to be able to enable businesses to realise returns on those investments, not risk-free, but to be able to realise returns on those investments over the long term. And I think the government's role really is to support all of that agenda across all of those sort of requirements, you know, are covered within the strategy.
So you've mentioned the different mechanisms that the government's put forth for stimulating innovation and private sector investment. I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about some of the new areas that SMS has entered. You mentioned energy storage, but some of those R&D projects that I know SMS quite heavily involved with now, with the likes of Innovate UK.
Yeah, what's these are sometimes termed R&D projects that we're really taking proven known technology solutions and just bringing them together with, you know, software platforms in particular to enable benefits to end customers. So it's, I wouldn't describe it as R&D in the sense of unproven sort of technologies, but what we are doing is bringing technologies together and trying to develop commercial models that provide certainties over the sort of revenues streams to support capital deployment in the way that I was describing. So yeah, the Reflex project in Orkney is a case in point, where we're seeking to deploy solar and storage to domestic and commercial properties aggregating the storage, the batteries within those properties together to be able to act as a virtual power plant supporting the energy grid. And Orkney is an area where there has been and is substantial sort of renewable generation, but a very high cost of transmission and distribution of energy because of the intermittency of that renewable generation. In a way, that's a microcosm of the, you know, UK energy grid in the future. So it's a perfect place to prove those sort of commercial models, if you like, and gain a lot of learning from doing so. And we, you know, being able to use our software platforms to aggregate those batteries together, vehicle to grid charges together, to be able to support the energy grid by providing flexibility services to the grid is a key part of the model. Now, within the Aberdeen project, the Doric project, as it's called, we take that a step further by taking a more whole house approach, where we also look at the fabric of the buildings and the energy efficiency of the buildings, which, as I said, is a key component, particularly when you're then trying to address the heat usage and decarbonisation, the use of heat within the home, by introducing other technologies like air source heat pumps. Now, air source heat pumps work slightly differently to, you know, traditional gas boilers. And really, you work effectively at a lower heat level. So you really need the energy efficiency of the home to be at a higher level in order to be able to get the level of comfort heating that people will expect. So having a whole house approach is important when you look at the heating side of things, but also being able to, again, plug those sort of heat sources, air source heat pumps as an example, into a flexibility platform to enable the grid to be managed, to avoid peak usage on the grid. If you consider one of the statistics I often use to describe the challenge that we have from an energy grid in the future is the fact that each home and the energy networks, the electricity networks for each home, when they're designed, assume an average of around 1.5 kilowatts of demand at any point in time per home. But then you consider the potential to connect electric vehicle chargers, air source heat pumps to homes, and the peak impact that could often have on the energy networks is very, very significant. So having the means to be able to control that demand on the network is going to be critical going forward, but also therefore enabling every consumer to take part in decarbonizing the grid and sharing in the revenues and the benefit from doing so is important as well. So the Aberdeen project takes that solar and storage solution one step further by considering a whole house approach. I think it's equally fair to say that the capital cost and the operating cost of air source heat pumps have still got a little way to go to be commercially viable compared to traditional gas boilers, if you like.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me on to the next question there. You mentioned the Doric project in Aberdeen, where SMS is working with Aberdeen City Council there to roll out these green technologies and make them more affordable and accessible to the tenants there, the end users. So I suppose that's one continuing debate and sticking point around the net zero challenge, is that subject of affordability and accessibility of the clean technologies that consumers are going to need to decarbonize their homes and their businesses. So we've seen the government recently announce its heat pump scheme, for example, which offers homeowners financial support in switching from those gas boilers to low carbon heat pumps. But consumers and businesses are going to need a lot more support, aren't they, going forward, if we're going to make the switch en masse as a population of homeowners and business owners to clean technologies. And this is, again, somewhere that the private sector is going to have to step in and bridge that funding gap in terms of those private finance mechanisms. So I know this is something that SMS is now looking to address through its so-called carbon reduction asset program. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I guess we're well known for our deployment, ownership and operation of smart meters. And we really see smart meters as the enabler for a different type of more flexible energy system, which is absolutely critical to that smart grid, to being critical to enabling the integration of intermittent renewable generation into the grid and all of that new peak demand onto the network. But smart meters, as I said, are really just an enabler, and then therefore the start of the process, really. And we've already extended that into other now established products like grid scale batteries, where we're addressing that that long-term requirement for battery storage to enable intermittent renewable generation to be connected to the grid, you know, national grid forecasting requirement for over 10 gigawatts of energy storage by 2030, over 30 gigawatts by 2050. And that will that requirement will only likely increase with some of the more recent announcements around trying to get to a you know, completely 100% sort of renewable source of generation by 2035. So we've got a very significant pathway ahead of activity in that area, not only around the short-term battery storage, which we're predominantly focused on at the moment, but also looking at longer duration energy storage as well. But as I said, I think there's then a fundamental requirement, you know, lower down the energy networks at the local distributor level for other solutions. So, for example, our solar power solution, which is looking to put energy storage and solar power panels, on domestic and commercial properties around the UK. And critically, that enables us to decarbonize the electricity supply of a home by up to 90%, but also to reduce the cost of the energy by up to 25%. And that's before the more recent sort of increases in energy costs. So I think addressing fuel poverty and is absolutely part of this agenda as well. I think when you look at the way energy costs have and the issues that the energy market has had over the recent months with the increase in wholesale gas prices, we can't ignore this. We need, you know, in the long term, the solution is to make the UK more self-sufficient in terms of energy generation, to make homes more self-sufficient in terms of their energy generation, and to enable them to use less energy. So solutions like our solar power one, which enable homes to go significantly off-grid, if you like, in terms of their generation and then the use of energy, a really important part of things. But taking a whole house approach in the long term that looks at heat and energy efficiency is going to be an important part of the picture. But I think what would concern me is, you know, some of that government strategy implies that, well, there are decisions to be taken down the line about how we will, particularly from a retrofitting perspective, address the existing housing stock in the UK. So, for example, there are decisions still to be taken about the involvement of hydrogen. There are decisions in the future about no new gas boilers. But I don't really think that addresses with any urgency the existing fabric and properties of the UK. One of my concerns would be that the government have indicated in some cases that there, for example, in the social housing area, that there is grant money coming down the line to support some of these solutions. And whilst that's terrific up to a point, what it can do is just lead to local authorities and housing associations delaying making investment decisions in partnership with the private sector whilst they think there might be grants coming down the line that would fund it in a different way. I think we need certainty for the private sector that the market opportunity is there and the right structures and provisions for that. But your private money and solutions like those that SMS is bringing will be made available, and the capital can be made available, I think, from the private sector to support them. But we need to get on and do these things. I think waiting for grant money or waiting for future decisions around heat pumps or boilers or heat, I think there's an urgency around this agenda, and everyone needs to get on and do those things which we can do now, even if there are other things that need to follow in the future. And I'm a firm believer that you should get on and do things that you can do, like solar and storage solutions now, even if some of the heating and energy efficiency sort of agenda comes a little further down the line, if you like. So I think, urgency from a government perspective just still needs to be accelerated a little bit. But those wider solutions that we bring to bear, so electric vehicle charging infrastructure, that solar power solution, the introduction of heat pumps in due course, and all plugging those into that flexibility platform that allows us to support the energy grid, I think provides, critical services to the UK, but provides a very long-term and sizable market opportunity for us as a business as well.
You talk about the urgency there of the UK's net zero plan in general. I'm sure that is something indeed that Boris Johnson and the UK government are going to be pressed on this week in their presidency of COP26, which is underway as we record. So, this I don't need to tell people this UN summit has gathered the world's leaders to discuss how we can cooperate and ramp up efforts to stop catastrophic climate change. And though official summit negotiations are taking place on a very high political and diplomatic level, during the opening ceremony, Prince Charles's speech actually very much made the point about, beyond our governments and policymakers, the need for the private sector to step up to the plate and take responsibility for stopping climate change. Now, something we haven't touched on here today, actually, is SMS's net zero commitment itself to reach carbon neutrality as a business by 2030. And that's something that the UK government, as I understand, has been pushed on in COP26 around whether net zero should become mandatory for publicly listed companies, at least, like SMS. So I'd just like to get your thoughts on that and to touch on SMS's net zero 2030 target as well.
Yeah, well, we've got a clear plan in place to address our own sort of carbon footprint and emissions. And as you say, that's to achieve that by 2030. You know, a significant part of our carbon emissions come from our fleet of vans and our transport costs, which is, you know, part of that agenda. And we've got a clear plan to how to get there by 2030. I think with things like should be mandatory, I'm never a massive fan of things like that being mandatory, but what I would say is that I tend to find that sometimes the private sector can be one step ahead sometimes. So you will already see the market with the focus on the ESG, environmental, social, and governance agenda is one step ahead. You know, as a listed business, not only do we feel a social obligation to have that sort of net zero target by 2030, our investors are calling us to have that as well. And I think investors will vote with their feet and their capital if businesses don't step up to that agenda, to be perfectly honest. So I'm not sure in that sense it needs to be mandatory, because I think the agenda and the market is already driving companies in that direction significantly already.
It's clear then, speaking to Tim, and I must say a big thanks to him for taking some time out to speak to me, that the urgent imperative is clearly there for organisations when it comes to contributing and indeed leading the net zero cause, whether that's reducing their own carbon footprints or investing more widely in carbon reducing energy solutions and business models. After all, net zero can and will only be achieved through innovation and collaboration. None more so than the private sector in partnership with the public sector. Now, fully appreciative that there was a lot covered in that episode, from the government's net zero strategy itself to the different projects and services that Tim mentioned. If you'd like to read and find out more about any or all of these, then I will be leaving a number of links in the episode description where you can click through and find out more. That's about all we have time for today, but before I go, I'd like to leave you with this, the stirring words of Sir David Attenborough from his speech at COP26 last week.
Perhaps the fact that the people most affected by climate change are no longer some imagined future generation, but young people alive today, perhaps that will give us the impetus we need to rewrite our story, to turn this tragedy into a triumph. We are, after all, the greatest problem solvers to have ever existed on Earth. We now understand this problem. We know how to stop the number rising and put it in reverse. We must recapture billions of tons of carbon from the air. We must fix our sights on keeping 1.5 degrees within reach. A new industrial revolution powered by millions of sustainable innovations is essential and is indeed already beginning. We're going to have to learn together how to achieve this, ensuring none are left behind. We must use this opportunity to create a more equal world. And our motivation should not be fear, but hope.